An American captive goes free. Today, Monday, August 25th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Just days after the brutal execution of James Foley, another American who was held hostage in Syria is released. A very welcome surprise for his family and friends.
Just immense relief, just overwhelming gratitude that he's alive and that his family has him back again.
The release of Theo Curtis raises questions, though, about the differences between his captors, the Nusra Front, and the group that murdered Foley.
So ISIS doesn't play well with others. Its ideology is just run amok.
And later, a rising tennis star from Canada.
She's a marketing dream, right? She's a very good-looking girl, and she doesn't grunt. She's nice and quiet.
What else makes Eugenie Bouchard special? Today on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. He's out of Syria now and safe. That's a word from U.S. officials on Peter Theo Curtis, the American freelance writer freed over the weekend in Syria. Curtis was kidnapped in 2012 and held by al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, or the Nusra Front. In a few minutes, we'll tell you more about that militant group and why they're moderates when compared with ISIS. First, more on Theo Curtis. Seems he had the great fortune of having the government of Qatar involved in negotiating for his freedom. Today we had hoped to hear from his family members, but they're obviously busy waiting for news of what's next for their son. We did reach someone who's celebrating Theo's return, his old high school sweetheart. The love chapter of their life ended, but Jennifer Style and Theo Curtis remained close friends. In fact, in 2006, Theo convinced her to move to Yemen to train Yemeni journalists at a small English language newspaper there. Jennifer is now a journalist and author based in La Paz, Bolivia, and that's where she was yesterday when she found out about Theo's release.
The family let me know yesterday, just before the media broke the story, and I was hugely relieved that they let me know as soon as possible because obviously, in the wake of the horror that happened to James Foley, that exacerbated everyone's worry about Theo, and just immense relief, just overwhelming gratitude that he's alive and that his family has him back again.
What has it been like, Jennifer, for 2 years as a friend of Theo's waiting for this news?
It's been a very anxious time. You know, I feel mostly for his family, for his mother, because as a parent, I just can't imagine anything worse than not knowing what's become of your child. And so the heartache has mostly been for his mother and his family, who have been working so unbelievably hard to find him.
Mm. And you two are close friends. That started in high school as high school sweethearts. And even though that chapter of your relationship ended, you stayed in touch. I mean, that means he must be pretty remarkable. What kind of man is Theo?
He's a character. You know, in high school, he was a mischief maker. He was had unlimited energy. He was super brilliant, really, really fine intellect, but also hugely full of fun and a little bit of trouble.
Were you worried about a mischief maker going to a place like the Mideast?
Well, Theo was the one who first invited me to Yemen in 2006 to go train journalists over there. And when I expressed concern about the security situation over there, he said, oh, you know, the U.S. State Department, they exaggerate. Everything's totally safe in Yemen, and you're in much greater danger of dying in an automobile accident than you are in a terrorist attack. He's a brilliant linguist. He speaks beautiful Arabic. He speaks several other languages fluently, French, German, I think even Russian. He's fearless. He has no sense of embarrassment. He will talk to anyone about pretty much anything.
So, Jennifer, you're speaking with us from Bolivia, where your life is now located. You're a former journalist. How much did Theo inspire you?
He inspired me in that he invited me to come to Yemen, which is not a place I ever would have gone had he not encouraged me to go there. He actually came to New York and spent time with me over a beer, convincing me that this was a wise decision to make with my life. And once I was in Yemen, you know, his ease at the culture inspired me to learn Arabic, to learn as much as I could about Yemen, to integrate myself with the people. And in all those ways, he inspired me. I wouldn't really be anywhere I am now without his without his encouragement.
Jennifer Style is a journalist and author and longtime friend of Thea Curtis, just released after 2 years by captors in Syria. Jennifer, great to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's still a lot we don't know about Thea Curtis, including what exactly he was doing in Syria. We do know that the group holding him was Jabhat al-Nusra, or the Nusra Front. It has nothing to do with the militant organization that calls itself the Islamic State, or ISIS, the group that beheaded Jim Foley last week. Nusra is affiliated with al-Qaeda. ISIS is not. Yeah, I know it's hard to keep track of these groups and their various levels of violence, so we asked Shadi Hamid to help us out. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of a new book on Islamist movements.
Jabhat al-Nusra is actually the official al-Qaeda franchise in Syria. And there is a very interesting and growing distinction between ISIS and the Islamic State on one hand and Jabhat al-Nusra on the other. ISIS was originally affiliated with al-Qaeda in its previous guise as al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they were disavowed by al-Qaeda because they were seen to be too brutal and too vicious. So now we actually have a kind of spectrum of brutality, and not all extremist groups are created equal. Of course, Jabhat al-Nusra is by definition an extremist group because it is an al-Qaeda franchise, but it hasn't been as ideologically rigid, as expansionist, and as brutal as ISIS has been. In fact, Jabhat al-Nusra, despite its extremist pedigree, has been willing to play pragmatic. It has been willing to work with non-extremist groups, non-extremist rebel groups, I should say.
So, Shadi, in your own mind, how do you keep Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State movement separate? I mean, what distinguishes them for you?
I see a real discernible difference when it comes to the level of pragmatism. So ISIS doesn't play well with others. It's extremely maximalist. Its ideology is just run amok. And you have a situation where they're pretty much beheading anyone who they consider to be a disbeliever. They're actually threatening to commit genocide against certain minority groups. So that's a kind of level of brutality that we haven't seen as much from Jabhat al-Nusra. Jabhat al-Nusra is actually more focused on fighting the Syrian regime. And in that sense, they're more Syrian. And the proportion of Syrian fighters to foreign fighters in Jabhat al-Nusra is quite different. ISIS is much more dependent on foreign fighters who are coming from all over the world. The ISIS, or what we would now call the Islamic State, is less a rebel group or less a terrorist group, and now is a proto-state. It controls territory. It runs local government. It administers services. It runs Sharia courts. It dispenses justice, obviously in a very brutal, harsh way, and run their ideal kind of Islamic utopia. That's how they would see it. Obviously, the reality is quite different for anyone who doesn't share their ideology.
So we know ISIS is not moderate, but maybe the Nusra Front is moderate compared to ISIS. But would you say they're moderate?
I think we have to be careful about this word moderate. When we're talking about the difference between Nusra and ISIS, we're talking about varying levels of extremism. So I would say Jabhat al-Nusra is less extreme. They're more pragmatic, but they're not what we as Americans would consider close to moderate.
By releasing Thea Curtis now, less than a week after that hideous execution of James Foley, what message do you think Jabhat al-Nusra is sending?
Well, there is definitely some attempt to draw a contrast with the Islamic State. So the very fact that it comes so close on the heels of what happened with James Foley is instructive. And Jabhat al-Nusra is trying to portray itself in a different light. I wouldn't go so far as to call this a charm offensive, but they are trying to show that they are amenable to mediation. They are amenable to negotiation and discussion on the issue of prisoners, where ISIS hasn't really been.
Shadi Hamid of the Brookings Institution there, and author of Temptations of Power, Islamists, and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Meanwhile, the U.S. military continues to carry out airstrikes against the Islamic State militants inside Iraq. And that's pretty significant considering President Obama's push to end American involvement in the war in Iraq. And the administration is considering going further by doing something it's been reluctant to do for more than 3 years. That's getting involved in the war in Syria by bombing Islamic State militants there. The World's Matthew Bell has this report.
For retired U.S. Marine Corps General John Allen, the beheading of journalist James Foley should be a wake-up call to everyone. These radicals are a clear and present danger to the U.S., Allen wrote in a forceful op-ed titled, "Destroy the Islamic State Now." At times, top U.S. officials have echoed that sentiment. They have talked about the group as evil, apocalyptic, and a cancer that must be confronted relentlessly. In light of Foley's murder, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said the extremists of the Islamic State represent an imminent threat to U.S. interests.
They have no standard of decency, of responsible human behavior, and I think the record's pretty clear on that. So, yes, they are an imminent threat to every interest we have, whether it's in Iraq or anywhere else.
But can the United States really destroy the Islamic State?
No, of course not.
Mark Lynch is a Middle East expert at George Washington University.
This was an organization which emerged and developed and was fighting its wars against us when we had 150,000 troops in Iraq. And it's still an open question as to whether we won that. We certainly didn't destroy them with all of those troops because they survived and they came back to fight us again.
The group Al-Qaeda in Iraq was the predecessor of the Islamic State, which now controls large swaths of territory in both Iraq and Syria. U.S. officials say the national border between the two countries has all but disappeared now for these militants. And the bottom line for the administration, says Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes, is to protect American lives from the threat of terrorism.
We have seen them pose a threat to our interests in the region, to our personnel and facilities in the region, and clearly the brutal execution of Jim Foley represented an affront, an attack, not just on him, but he's an American, and we see that as an attack on our country when one of our own is killed like that.
But Mark Lynch says there's a disconnect between some of the more heated rhetoric from the Obama administration and the military options that it's thinking through.
And I fear that what's happening now is that you're seeing certain administration officials who are laying out a very strong case in support of intervention, but it's not at all clear that that is something that the United States will be able to actually deliver upon, or even that it should try.
Lynch's colleague at George Washington University, Stephen Biddle, is an expert on counterinsurgency strategy. Here's what the administration is actually considering, he says, sending between 10 and 15,000 U.S. troops to help fight the Islamic State. Those troops would mostly direct American airstrikes and help train local security forces. But Biddle says the administration has to stop talking about eradicating the Islamic State, or ISIL, altogether.
If that's your goal, then in principle you could imagine that an ISIL that isn't expanding, but that retains a base in Syria that you're not going to be able to destroy, might be far from ideal, but relatively tolerable. Either way, if the policy is going to succeed, the aims and the means have to be brought into alignment.
Asked if the Obama administration is actively considering sending more troops or bombing Islamic State militants inside Syria, Ben Rhodes said he didn't want to get ahead of anything being discussed inside the White House.
We're actively considering what's going to be necessary to deal with that threat, and we're not going to be restricted by borders. We've shown time and again that if there's a counterterrorism threat, we'll take direct action against that threat if necessary.
In the meantime, Rhodes said the U.S. will support its partners in Iraq, and he suggested that the American air campaign will continue there as well. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Still ahead on The World, Richard Attenborough and his odd entry into the Gandhi-Nehru dynasty on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. You know how when you're flying, you sometimes look out your window and see another plane in the distance? Well, that's just it. The other plane is usually at a safe distance away. Try coming within 20 feet of another jet. That's exactly what happened last week when a Chinese fighter jet came uncomfortably close to a U.S. surveillance plane. It happened about 130 miles off the coast of Hainan Island in international airspace. David Shambaugh directs the China Policy Program at George Washington University, and he tells me that this happens more often than we think.
There have been several such close encounters with very risky behavior by the Chinese pilots over recent months. And there have been several diplomatic demarches made by the U.S. government to the Chinese government each time. This most recent case, though, is quite worrying, and the details that we have of it so far reminds one of the accident back in 2001, the so-called EP-3 incident, in which an American reconnaissance plane almost crashed into the sea. In fact, the Chinese fighter pilot that was hot-dogging around that plane did crash into the sea, and he died. The American plane landed on China's Hainan Island. The crew was kept for about 10 days before being released. So this is a repetitive pattern.
A repetitive pattern, but why are you especially worried about this one? I mean, what makes this so concerning?
Well, as you said in your introductory remarks, 20 feet is pretty close when you're up in the air at that height. And the Chinese fighter buzzed the American reconnaissance plane several times, including flying right across its nose at a 90-degree angle, doing also what they call a barrel roll just above the American reconnaissance plane. And it was just clearly provocative and, put it mildly, highly unprofessional behavior.
I mean, when the Pentagon reacts so strongly, there's a sense that this kind of thing could have been avoided. Are these buzz-bys ever intentional? Do you think this one was? And why would an Air Force actually do that?
Of course it was intentional. As I say, it's out in international airspace. This American reconnaissance plane was outfitted with a lot of intelligence gathering equipment to monitor Chinese submarines. And it has to be said that the Americans patrol up and down along the Chinese coast 365 days a year, albeit out in international airspace. But nonetheless, from the Chinese perspective, this is highly provocative behavior, and they don't like it. And their one way to deter it, they think, is to intercept these flights. It's a cat and mouse game. It goes on all the time. It's just not reported in the media until there's a close incident like this.
So if this especially close call at 20 feet is a concern of the Pentagon, how could it affect U.S.-Chinese relations?
Well, it could result in a mid-air crash in which both planes would go down and lives would be lost, and it would produce a major incident, a national security crisis, one can say, between the U.S. and China, just as it did back in 2001 during the Bush administration. That was very tense for, I think, 10 days. It was finally defused with a letter written by the American ambassador that was a de facto apology to the Chinese.
So why do you think the Chinese would make this provocation now?
That's the big question everybody in the community is wondering about. Is this just a hot dog pilot acting on his own, or is he under orders from his base or even higher up in the Chinese system? The Chinese government, of course, has denied that this ever happened or is happening, but we know it's happening. We have photographs to prove it.
That was George Washington University's David Shambaugh. Okay, confession, I don't like shopping for clothes, but at least I can usually find things in my size. I fall somewhere in the middle of the American bell curve for clothing, but finding the right fit is just not that easy for Ping Huang. Here's her story.
Let's just be clear. I'm short, like really short. I'm 4'9 and 3/4, which is about the size of a 9-year-old girl. But I am an adult. I'm 30 years old, Asian American, and my size is not that unusual for someone of my background. But here in America, clothes off the racks just do not fit. Pants are super baggy. Necklines plunge down to my ribs. So I often wind up wearing children's clothes. But this comes with its own problems. Shirts and dresses are designed for the flat-chested, which I am not. And don't even get me started on the bows and frills. When it comes to clothes, America is telling me, I'm not a girl, but not a woman. So I was really excited to hear that Uniqlo was coming to town. Uniqlo is a clothing chain from Japan. It's often described as a Japanese version of the Gap. And it's been around for a few years in New Jersey, New York, and San Francisco. But this fall, they're kicking off a big U.S. expansion that includes my hometown, Boston. Their clothes are simple and basic, but the part that matters to me, their sizing. It consistently runs small. I showed up at their Boston pop-up store on opening day. It was a hot summer afternoon, and the music was thumping. I explained my sizing issues to sales associate Rachel Arani.
Yeah, actually, that's who our clothing is made for everyone, but especially we accommodate to small people. And our sizing is actually a little bit small because our clothing originated in Japan, as you may know.
Rachel was standing next to a wall of tank tops, which she totally recommended.
We have these Aerism tops, which fit everyone really nicely, and they stretch really well. They are odor-proof, and they are dry fit, super light, and they do run a size smaller than most American sizing, but you'd probably be like an extra small or a small in these.
In a typical store, extra small is large in me, but at Uniqlo, it was the small that fit. $20 for a shirt that was flattering and odor-proof? I was sold. Outside the store, I ran into Kazuka Kuwahara. She looked about my size, so I asked her where she shops.
I shop at Anthropology, but to be honest, their clothes don't fit me.
But where did she get her cute summer dress?
I mean, I bought this from TJ Maxx, and it's like, kind of fits me.
That's kind of how I feel about most of my clothes. And it's not just me. There are a lot of people here in this country who don't fit American sizes. So having a place like Uniqlo in our neighborhood, it's a big deal. But the rest of America could be raining on our parade. It turns out that Uniqlo has gotten complaints since opening here. One internet reviewer said he was tortured by the sizing. And the fashion blog Racked quipped that Uniqlo was starting to realize that, unlike the Japanese, American women are not paper dolls. The truth is, Uniqlo's U.S. operations are not profitable. Collectively, their 25 stores on the East and West Coasts are in the red. And one of their biggest challenges in breaking into the U.S. mainstream market is sizing. Yuya Tanahashi, Uniqlo's Boston area manager, calls it an ongoing struggle for the brand.
So we're actually analyzing every year about the fit.
Basically, they're checking sales data in each of their stores around the world, including here.
Yeah, we're going to try to, you know, find out the best fit for the Boston customers as well by analyzing, you know, which item sells and which sizes sells.
The company says they're looking into changing the sizes they offer in the U.S. In their words, they're figuring out how to provide a more 3D fit for American shoppers. So all those glorious, form-flattering smalls in the Boston store, they may not be small for long. But Tanahashi did offer me this.
Actually, we have kids line as well. And it's kind of, you know, many adults actually purchase kids line, meaning the boys and the girls style. So I will try to recommend the girls style as well.
The kids section, again? For the world, I'm Ping Huang, Boston.
I'm sure Ping isn't the only one with this problem. Some of you must also struggle to find clothes that fit. Where do you shop for clothes, and how has it changed, or has it not changed, and you're still struggling? Let us know at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, Richard Attenborough was an Oscar-winning film director, but he did not see himself as a master of his craft.
It's the actual material that fascinates me, not the process of actually making films. I'm not an auteur in any sense. I want to tell stories.
Remembering Attenborough, ahead on the world.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You know, summer's that time of year when, no matter how nice it is outside, I can get glued to the TV. It starts in late May with the French Open, then continues with Wimbledon. Now the American slice of the Grand Slam, the U.S. Open, which starts today. This year, keep your eyes peeled for a rarity at this tournament, a Canadian tennis star. There haven't been many of them since the game was invented, but Canadians have their eyes trained on number 7 seed Eugenie Bouchard from Montreal. She's just 20, and she made it all the way to the Wimbledon final last month, so definitely a rising star in the tennis world. Stephanie Miles is a sports writer for Yahoo. She's also a tennis fanatic and joins us now from the early action at Flushing Meadows in Queens. Should we believe all the hype about Eugenie Bouchard piled on a lot by the likes of Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova? Is she that good?
It's all hype until someone actually delivers. You know what I mean? And she's been getting the full treatment from just about everywhere that she's going to be the next big thing. And she may be, you know, and she has all the tools that she needs. The biggest thing, I think, is big-time self-belief and confidence. The sky's the limit for her, really.
I mean, she's getting the full treatment, but she hasn't won a Grand Slam yet. Why are a lot of people so excited about her?
She hasn't won a Grand Slam, but look, there have been a lot of players who've gotten to number one without winning one. There aren't that many people winning them, so that's fine. She's had a great year at the Grand Slams this year, but look, she's a marketing dream, right? She's blonde-haired and blue-eyed, and she's a very good-looking girl, and she doesn't grunt. She's nice and quiet. She speaks English very well, and you know all those things. She's got the right package, so I think she's going to make a whole lot of money, that's for sure.
I mean, we've seen a few female marketing dreams on the court in years past. What is Eugenie Bouchard really good at?
She's not really great at any one particular thing, but if you look at most of the women, that's probably true of most of them. She does everything well. And she competes well, I think, is probably the biggest thing, because especially on the women's side, the women who are the best competitors are usually the ones who are at the top of the game. Just because everybody has some talent. They all have a lot of talent or they wouldn't be there. But the ones who are the best competitors, the ones who handle the tough moments the best, I think are the ones who succeed. And there are a lot of people who might have one big skill. Like, for example, you look at Sabine Lisicki, who just set the power speed serving record a few weeks ago. But she's 26 in the world. So it's nice to have that one big skill. But I would say, generally speaking, you're better off having the package.
Now, she's got, not surprisingly, a lot of fans in Canada. She even has this thing called the Genie Army. Who are they and how fanatical are they?
It's funny, you know, because I was at the Australian Open this year, and this group of guys showed up on this court, which is the furthest away you could possibly get from the center court at the Australian Open, and they had their matching T-shirts, and they were ready to go, and they had their songs ready to go and everything. And so I asked them, I said, so why Eugenie Bouchard? And it was really sort of random, you know. They said, oh, yeah, they thought she was a really great-looking girl, and they figured, well, we'll go cheer for her. And it sort of snowballed. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty simple. And they didn't analyze her forehand and her backhand or anything. So it just sort of went from there, and obviously she had a great run in the tournament.
I mean, in Canada, Eugenie's face is everywhere. On fashion magazines, it's the face of Coca-Cola. Do you reckon that there are some Canadians who know she's a beautiful woman but don't even know she plays tennis?
Well, you know what? I wouldn't say that her appeal is quite that widespread yet. The fashion magazine that she was in is a Quebec fashion magazine, a French language one in the province, and I believe the Coke deal is not. It started off just as a Quebec deal. So she's not a fully national celebrity.
She's on slow rollout nationally in Canada, huh?
Well, you know what? It's tennis. It's tennis, and I think that it's unusual, obviously, for Canada, at least in the last 20 or so years, to have a big deal, a female athlete in an individual sport. So as the agents were telling me, they really are sort of blazing new territory there and working on convincing the companies of exactly the appeal of this, because, yeah, there's really not too much of a blueprint for it. So I think, as I said, I think she's going to make a lot of money. And obviously the fact that she's a great-looking girl can't hurt.
Stephanie Miles is a sports writer with Yahoo. She spoke with us from Flushing Meadows at the U.S. Open in New York about rising Canadian tennis star Eugenie Bouchard. Thanks a lot, Stephanie.
Okay, no problem.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is an international organization with some 15 million Mormons spread across the world. One key to that expansion, those earnest young men going door-to-door inviting people to hear about Jesus. And yes, they are mostly men. But more and more women are joining their ranks. The overall number of Mormon missionaries is also growing after the church decided to lower the age requirements for both genders. Women still have to be older than men, though, and serve for shorter periods. Reporter Jane Little went to Utah to find out why. She got a rare glimpse inside the church's busiest training center as a new crop of recruits arrived.
All right, just go right in these doors, and I'll meet you on the other side.
This is the Missionary Training Center in Provo, Utah. And here we've got 500 fresh-faced young men and women arriving for the first time to train to go out across the world in twos to witness to their Mormon faith.
Good luck, sweetie. You'll be awesome. Love you so much.
Love you too.
On any given year, right now, we're training about 36,000 missionaries here in this missionary training center.
Spencer Christiansen is head of operations here and a busy man. The church announced a policy shift at the end of 2012, lowering the entry age for men from 19 to 18 and for women from 21 to 19. As an attempt to boost the missionary force, it worked. Since then, the numbers have shot up to almost 90,000, and women have embraced the change.
Before that change, the average would have been close to between 10 and 15%, so more than doubled the amount of young women that are serving missions, and of course we're very, very excited about that.
But why the age difference? Why do you have to be a year older? Many people think that women tend to mature earlier than men.
I've got to be honest and tell you I don't know all the reasons for that, but I don't.
Gender roles have been clearly defined in Mormonism, and a woman's first duty was to marry young and have lots of children. So many have celebrated this move as a step forward, though women still only do 18 months, while men serve for 2 years. Six young men and 5 young women show off what they've learned in Mandarin class. They've just 9 weeks to study this language, and then they're off to Taiwan. China is off limits. The men wear white shirts and name badges that say elder. The women, modest skirts and blouses with badges that say sister. The mission involves leaving one's family for the duration. They're never to watch TV. And of course, there's no alcohol or premarital sex. And the training is intense. Scripture, gym and many language classes.
So, 当基督在世上
They teach 55 of them here, and no one gets to choose which they study or where they go. They could even be asked to learn a foreign language so they can focus on converting ethnic minorities in an English-speaking country, as this teacher did.
My name's Sister Michaela Merrill. I just returned from my mission, and I was Chinese-speaking in Manchester, England.
Ah, you've got the accent, I can hear it.
Yeah.
Did you feel you accomplished much on the mission?
Yeah, I think we accomplished a lot. Our purpose as missionaries is to invite people to grow closer to Jesus Christ and to learn more about him. So we worked a lot with Chinese students at the universities in Manchester and Liverpool, and we met a lot of wonderful people that did grow closer to the Savior.
Two of Michaela's students, Megan Porter and Rachel Cosby, signed up because of the recent change in age rules. Both are 19.
I was really excited about it.
Yeah, it was 21 before. And I just thought, that age is a little hard. You know, you're right in the middle of all your schooling. And so when they lowered it, that was the tipping point for me to say, oh yeah, I really want to go.
Still, men can go earlier, right, at 18. Mm-hmm. Why the difference?
I don't know if I know the specific reason, but I do know that it's given them more of an opportunity to start off their adulthood the right way.
But do you think girls should be able to go at the same age?
You know, I don't personally see it as a bad thing that I go later.
We're starting to see these first women, these younger women now return from their missions. We're going to have tens of thousands of theologically trained women injected into the ranks of the church worldwide.
Mike Otterson is a former journalist from Liverpool who converted to Mormonism. He became the managing director of public affairs for the church based in Salt Lake City.
I think most of the women in the church, they find plenty of fulfillment in what they do. There's plenty of opportunity. But for some who want to do more, maybe who are not ready to get married or whatever, and they want to do more, how do you utilize that talent? How do you magnify that? How do you make the person feel completely fulfilled? That's a healthy discussion to have. It's a discussion that's happening already.
But some discussions aren't so healthy, as one woman and former missionary Kate Kelly discovered when she led a campaign to ordain women to the priesthood. She was recently excommunicated. And Mike Otterson makes clear that no matter how theologically trained these sisters are, there's no prospect of becoming priests. As for my unanswered question on why women have to be older than men when they go, and for that matter, why they serve for a shorter term.
Elder Jeffrey Holland, one of the apostles who was over the missionary department, was asked that question during a press conference, and his response was, "One miracle at a time."
For the world, I'm Jane Little, Salt Lake City.
The This next story makes you really wonder when the gas is going to run out in the Elvis tank. The king died more than 35 years ago, but it seems no matter where you go in the world, even in the midst of violence and tragedy, there's still room for some people's thing with Elvis Presley. Like in the Mideast right now. I mean, the rockets and the missiles are flying again between Israel and Hamas. But in the small window of a recent ceasefire, some Israelis managed to commemorate the latest anniversary of Elvis's passing. Daniela Cheslow has that story.
I come every August. I come here.
Yossi Rosen drove up to Neve Ilan outside Jerusalem from a town in the Israeli desert for the chance to sing Blue Suede Shoes. He's one of half a dozen men crooning to customers seated at circular tables. But rather than a Vegas nightclub, this is the Elvis Inn, a classic American diner. Patrons eat French fries and hamburgers, along with some more local fare like platters of hummus. The event is held annually, but this year it's been overshadowed by the war in Gaza. Behind Yossi, every wall is covered in Elvis photos, concert posters, and album covers. There are Elvis statues in the windows and sitting at some of the tables. It's a collection owner Uri Yoeli amassed over four decades in business. The Elvis Inn is a pretty popular spot with locals and tourists, but you might say this summer's been a time of troubled water.
Well, it's not, how can I explain? No people, no tourists at all. And we sit here and we listen to Elvis alone, without people. It's sad, you know. It's a little bit sad.
The Israeli finance ministry estimates the conflict in Gaza has chipped 0.5% off the national economy. Restaurants and hotels took the hardest hit. Israeli eateries have lost at least $100 million this summer. Uri says he's only now starting to recover from a month-long slowdown, and the Elvis anniversary day was a welcome break from the summer doom and gloom. Just tell me. Elvis died August 16, 1977. By then, Uri had already opened his Elvis Diner, and a few years later, he invited Elvis impersonators to mark the king's birthday, January 8th, and the day of his death with a party.
I'm now wearing a black pants, black shirt, and a white jacket with the eagle staring at the back. So that's why I was thinking, you know. I was thinking to look like Elvis.
Aaron Lavrone is the house Elvis. His black hair is slicked back in a pompadour. He speaks to me outside the restaurant, where a statue of Elvis towers over the front door. When there are no other singers, Aaron goes through his repertoire. Every Elvis song ever recorded. His English is Southern American twang with an Israeli accent. And yes, this is the second time someone is singing Bridge Over Troubled Water.
I think the spirit of Elvis is inside me, and I'll sing it, that's all.
Moti Regev, a sociologist at the Open University of Israel in Ra'anana, says it's not as strange as you might think to see this kind of kitsch in Israel. Elvis shook up the same feelings in Israelis as he did around the world, a youth rebellion.
There were hardly any electric guitars in Israel in the late 50s, early 60s. You'd never heard them. And in this regard, Elvis had and sort of an certain implicit political meaning of performing rebellion.
Elvis created the same waves in Israel as he did in the U.S., inspiring long sideburns and flared pants, maybe a little more swiveling of the hips. Today, Regev says, Elvis as an enduring symbol is wearing off in Israel. Most of the singers at the anniversary event were over age 60, and when they're gone, that may be it. For the world, I'm Daniela Cheslow, Neve Ilan, Israel.
Oh,
Just ahead, hanging out with Lord Attenborough and Nehru on The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. If you love movies, you're in mourning today for Richard Attenborough. The British film legend passed away yesterday at the age of 90. As a director, Attenborough scored huge hits with films like Gandhi and Cry Freedom. But he was an actor, too, on the cast of Spielberg's Jurassic Park, for instance, and in lots of other movies. Our BBC colleague Vincent Dowd looks back at Attenborough's long career.
Richard Attenborough's screen career started in 1942 in the classic naval drama In Which We Serve, but his career took off 5 years later, playing the psychopathic Pinky in the dark thriller Brighton Rock.
It won't hurt.
What won't hurt, Pinky?
Dying together. If the worst happens, we gotta act quick. You don't want to see me hang, do you?
No!
Attenborough was never glamorous, but he was ambitious and had a rare talent for self-reinvention. He and his brother David, later famous as a BBC broadcaster, grew up with socially conscious parents. In the late 30s, his mother decided to help victims of the Spanish Civil War.
They brought back 50 Basque refugee orphans, and she looked after 50 kids from the north of Spain. They brought refugees from Germany. So my life has been determined in no small measure by their example. That was the way to behave.
But social conscience had to wait while Attenborough acted in some rather ordinary films of the 1950s and on stage. In 1952 in London, he was the original police officer in Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap. In 1960, frustrated at the way his career was going, he produced his first film. And in 1969 came a big budget surprise.
Granny, what did Daddy do in the war?
With Oh, What a Lovely War, Attenborough proved he could handle a complex production as both producer and director.
But on Saturday I'm willing, if you'll only take the shilling, to make a man of any one of you.
The film showed real flair, but what had been important, he later said, was the material's underlying quality.
And that has applied in almost anything and everything I've ever done. It is the actual material that fascinates me, not the process of actually making films. I'm not an auteur in any sense. I want to tell stories.
And there was one story which Richard Attenborough tried for years to tell. Getting finance for a movie about Gandhi proved a long labour of love. The fascination had begun as a teenager.
I remember going to see a newsreel, Gandhiji arriving, maybe in the East End, I can't remember, and people laughed and giggled at the image of this man in this dhoti, this sheet. And my father saying to me, sotto voce, Richard, that is one of the great men of our time.
Despite the best intentions of the best of you, you must, in the nature of things, humiliate us to control us. It is time you left.
With respect, Mr. Gandhi, without British administration, this country would be reduced to chaos.
Defying the doubters, in 1982, Gandhi took 8 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor for Ben Kingsley.
There is no people on earth who would not prefer their own bad government to the good government of an alien power.
This is the Stephen Biko.
You stand up to him any way he chooses.
Stephen Biko.
In 1987 came Cry Freedom, another factual drama about the relationship between the white South African journalist Donald Woods and the black activist Steve Biko.
I'm talking about the indirect violence you get through starvation in the townships. I'm talking about the hopelessness, the desolation of the transit camps. Now, I think that constitutes more terrorism than the words these men have spoken here, but they stand charged, and white society is not charged.
Next came a total flop, his version of the musical A Chorus Line, and then a quieter, character-driven piece.
Sure.
Shadowlands, about the writer C.S. Lewis, was, he thought, his best film. In 1993, he became Lord Attenborough. At Christmas 2004, his daughter Ginny and granddaughter Lucy were killed in the Indian Ocean tsunami. It was a huge burden to bear in his 80s. In 2007, he said his greatest hope was that his much-loved parents would have approved of what he'd done in life.
I would like them to say to me, in a way, Dick, that's all right. What you've done is all right and acceptable. If I could manage that, I would be very happy.
At times, Richard Attenborough was mocked as rather theatrical in his public pronouncements. He was never the most fashionable of filmmakers, but his best works, such as Gandhi and Shadowlands, turned a character actor into one of the most successful directors of his generation.
The BBC's Vincent Dowd. We wanted to add one last bit of Lord Attenborough, of him remembering the early days of getting Gandhi to the screen. The movie was 20 years in the making. Attenborough's personal obsession was the man, and getting a movie about his life produced. And the way Attenborough wanted to do it, in India, in public, getting it authentically right, meant he had to talk to the right people. And that meant getting to people in high places like Prime Minister Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru.
I remember going to see him at 8:30 on a Monday morning, and he had that marvellous ability, which some people have, to persuade you immediately that you were the one person on earth that he wanted to meet at 8:30 on a Monday morning.
One problem, Nehru's assistant gave Attenborough precisely 30 minutes for the meeting. Prime Minister Nehru, Attenborough said, did not make that easy.
After about 3 hours, we were literally sitting on the floor, he most gracefully, me most inelegantly, looking through picture albums. And he was telling me this anecdote and that anecdote and so on. And finally he said, well, now, of course you must meet the cabinet. You must meet everybody involved. We'll give you every help you want, and you must have total facilities and research facilities and so on. Oh, of course, he said, and you must meet my daughter. And he picked up the phone. He said, Indra, I'm sending an English actor up to have lunch. You give him lunch and then send him back to me. And so I met Mrs. Gandhi.
Attenborough was suddenly an insider to the whole Nehru-Gandhi dynasty, and that helped when he actually began filming in 1980. When you've got a funeral scene with an estimated 400,000 extras, you better have officials on your side. Richard Attenborough died yesterday at the age of 90. You're hearing Ravi Shankar's composition titled Discovery of India, which composed for Richard Attenborough's Gandhi. For many of us who had never been to India, Attenborough's movie was, above all, a trip of discovery. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney-Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Ford Foundation, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.